Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Kiran Desai. Her novel, The Inheritance of Loss, has been published in paperback by Grove. It is the Man Booker Prize winner for 2006, and recently it also won the National Book Critics Circle Award, which makes it quite an extraordinary book. Now, I read an interview with you when you were in which you were talking about the experience of perfection in the novel. And I wondered, since to my mind people are more often talking about the loose baggy monster than about perfection, what novels have given you the experience of perfection as a reader?
Certain novels, I think, do come across as you just think, this is a perfect novel, but maybe perfect in one way. I mean, I think of reading, for example, I'm just pulling one thing out of my head, reading in Cold Blood. Perfect book. You think it's perfectly balanced. It's a work that really seems exactly right. But I think, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on producing, say, a perfect short story these days. This seems to be an age of the perfect short story. Everywhere you look, there's one that's edited, you know, every little bit of extra material cut out the sentences. You never have to question what they mean. It's just it's balanced. There it is. And I think it's perhaps being catered to in all kinds of ways. Writing workshops, publishers out to producing stuff, but to me that's not what I look for in a work. Talking of perfection or non-perfection, imperfection, having struggled with a book that I think is very imperfect, I was very much advised to make it more perfect. I was told by a lot of editors and publishers that, yes, that the balance was wrong. It was messy. It jumped, it hopped, it moved to a quirky rhythm. It wasn't structured according to any kind of architectural structure. I mean, if it was a building, it would collapse. It's not in balance. And yet, when I look at, say, all these, something like these perfect short stories, you wonder about the human response. I mean, sometimes to something that is perfect, one immediately feels that one has no real human response to perfection. You have to say, well, it's perfect. They think, what you think of such and such story, it's perfect. It was written so, you know, nobody would be offended by it, that everyone would pass it by and accept it. It's fine. It's perfect. And yet you're not having that feeling that, you know, you read for a messy book, a difficult book, early Truman Capote, all imperfect and so wonderful. I love those early books, Grasshop, and it was, you know, was one of my favorite books. And you could argue and say this problem or that problem, and yet you love those books. And
yes, when I read Breakfast at Tiffany's or Other Voices, Other Rooms, you just think, well, yes. They're extraordinarily beautiful.
They're extraordinarily beautiful. Other Voices, Other Rooms is a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And working on this book, I sort of thought, well, as a reader, and as a writer, I'm tolerant of imperfection. You know, I don't mind if a book is messy, because sometimes when it's raw, difficult, messy, not polished, it gives you more. It still gives you more. I'm willing to take an imperfect book for the richness it gives me. I'll put up with extra characters, plot that's going nowhere for a while.
Well, it's especially useful in this regard to remember that the book that was called A Loose Baggy Monster was War and Peace.
Oh, was it? Oh, I didn't know. Yes, oh, that's completely new to me. How funny.
Well, the
we should all be writing, yes, clearly.
Yes, 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 yes. Perfection isn't necessary. No. The Inheritance of Loss centers around, in particular, four characters. Mm. And I wondered, given the interest in messiness, why these four? What they meant to you?
There were so many characters. This book was 1,800 pages long, 1,500, wow. 800, 500, finally 300. So I was, you know, sort of editing out a lot of what seemed to be bagginess. But I think I was really trying to find a honesty of location, which was very difficult to come to. I think it's a hard place for an immigrant it's hard to force yourself to an honest place as an immigrant. It was quite a difficult journey, and I was trying to find the emotional heart of the story, a way to tell a story that really had no plot. There's no plot in this book. The way it's structured is just drawing emotional parallels, historical parallels between people in very different places and in different time periods. So I had to find the characters that could best tell the story. The judge came very early, as you know, sort of my realization that my own story could only be seen in the perspective of other stories in relation to older stories, that it wasn't a brave new story. It was an old story. My story is one that's been going on for a long time. We may call it by a different name, but essentially there seemed to be so much, there seemed to be something so similar to my journey to America, my grandfather's to England, and I came up with the character of the judge. Because, of course, that's such a particularly fascinating a question of what it must have been to be a judge in a country like India under the British administration, working for the British administration in a world of such imbalance.
He is in a house that we're in. It's the central narration point for the book.
Yes.
A house now in desuetude that was built by a Scotsman. He, because of his experience in England, he has grown to be a solitary man. He doesn't like people very much. He was so humiliated when he went to London to study and to eventually become a part of the British administration of India, that in a certain way, his life is beaten out of him. He doesn't like the color of his skin. He comes back with a powder puff to make his skin
pinker. Which is actually
pinker.
Quite a common story.
Really?
It wasn't made up at all. Mm.
And he is living with a granddaughter who has come back to the house after many years away. Her name is Sai, and with a cook. And the other character in the book is the cook's son, who has gone to America. His name is Biju, and he doesn't have papers. He's in the game or the vaudeville of seeking a green card. And one of the things that I noticed in the book, and I say vaudeville intentionally, is that you've risked something that I haven't seen in a very long time. We no longer think that we can talk about the people who live in poverty in New York in ways that have anything to do with ethnic stereotyping. And yet all of popular theater and popular literature and literature itself depends upon Mr. Gallagher and Mr. Sheen, the Irish cop. The whole immigrant experience is dependent upon the jokes and cliches they made for the life of the streets. This was once America when it could be spoken of easily as a melting pot.
Yes.
So the book is very refreshing in its sense of humor about the kinds of people in New York who are trying to escape the life of a cliché into the life of the culture.
Yes. No, it's funny. It's really funny you say that, because I think one of the lines in the book is, here in America where every culture confirms its stereotype. And in a way, when everybody arrives, of course, that's immediately how you tend to see America. That's how, you know, suddenly there's the world, and you arrive from another side of the world. This is where we all meet in the cities of the West. This is where the developing world is meeting for the first time in the basement kitchens of the Western world. And there's suddenly all these stereotypes you've been brought up with. There you are, sort of, you know, immediately dealing with it. And in a way, you know, I'm very conscious of the fact that if you identify yourself in this particular way, you can sort of, you have access to certain jokes and you have access to certain sort of humor that is dependent on seeing people in that way. Once you exit it, once you become part of a sort of generic mainstream culture where you can't really find those jokes funny anymore, and it's not all right to find that, look at people like that, or to find those jokes funny, you lose it. And you see a lot of writers, you know, realizing they've lost it, hoping to hold on to it. And then I think as a writer also, you're forced to identify yourself. Are you an Indian author? Are you an American Indian author? Are you just an author? I mean, so long as I think you identify yourself as an Indian author, it's all right to make those jokes.
Now, there is a vision in the book. They come briefly of the past, and I thought I'd ask you to read a section in which Bijou in America is thinking about a time when his father, the cook, has talked to him about the way it was. He is thinking of a conversation he had with his father and his experiences, and up above from the house, Sai, an orphan, is looking down jealously, really. She's happy that Bijou goes to America to seek his fortune because the cook has been her inherited father.
Yes.
He's the only one who treats her with love.
Yes.
And she doesn't want to share that love.
Yes.
This is Kiran Desai reading a passage from The Inheritance of Loss.
Lying on his basement shelf that night, he thought of his village where he had lived with his grandfather on the money his father sent each month. The village was buried in silver grasses that were taller than a man and made a sound, shoo-shoo, shoo-shoo, as the wind turned them this way and that. Down a dry gully through the grasses, you reached a tributary of the Jamuna, where you could watch men traveling downstream on inflated buffalo skins, the creature's very dead legs, all four, sticking straight up as they sailed along. And where the river scalped shallow over the stones, they got out and dragged their buffalo skin boats over. Here at the shallow place, Bijou and his grandmother would cross on market trips into town and back, his grandmother with her sari tucked up, sometimes a sack of rice on her head. Fishing eagles hovered above the water, changed their horizontal glide within a single moment, plunged, rose sometimes with a thrashing muscle of silver. A hermit also lived on this bank, positioned like a stork, waiting for the glint of another, an elusive mystical fish. When it surfaced, he must pounce, lest it be lost again and never return. On Diwali, the holy man lit lamps and put them in the branches of the peepal tree and sent them down the river on rafts and marigolds. How beautiful the sight of those lights bobbing in that young dark. When he had visited his father in Kalimpong, they had sat outside in the evenings, and his father had reminisced. How peaceful our village is, how good the roti tastes there. It is because the atta is ground by hand, not by machine, and because it is made on a chula, better than anything cooked on a gas or kerosene stove. Fresh roti, fresh butter, fresh milk, still warm from the buffalo. They had stayed up late. They had noticed Zai, then aged 13, staring from her bedroom window, jealous of the cook's love for his son. Small, red-mouthed bats drinking from the jhora had swept over again and again in a witch flap of black wings.
Kiran Desai, reading a passage from The Inheritance of Loss. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Kiran Desai, author most recently of The Inheritance of Loss, published by Grove Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Kiran Desai about her Booker Prize-winning and National Book Critics Circle Award-winning The Inheritance of Loss. Now, in a passage like that, an American reader comes to a phrase like, milk fresh from the buffalo, fresh milk.
It doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound so good. Yes.
But it's part of the beauty of this book that what we're witnessing from various vantage points, that man, that holy man, who's watching by the river for a mystical fish, becomes one of the homeless people of New York. And again and again, what we watch in this book is, which is organized really musically, and that is its...
Now, that's a beautiful connection for you to make. I would not have made it, but you're right, there's a parallel between.
Yes, and we see people. That the judge who has encountered his first dog in London when he's staying in a rooming house now... loves his dog.
Suddenly realizes that dogs have personalities.
Yes. And again and again, we get reprises, you know, from different parts of the history and the life, things that happen in one country that happen somewhat differently in another. And that's part of what the book does, to put experience into perspective and see how when you go to a new place, your experience of the past is altered by the present.
Well, I guess you know the past is not what you've left behind. it changes depending on your perspective, and of course we all know history really is just merely a story. We may fight over whose story is the correct one, but in the end, that's what it is.
Now, you are the child of a novelist. And so that must be part of the sense of repeating within generations.
Yes, it is. It's very disconcerting at sometimes. And sometimes it's sort of, you know, I don't even realize it. It's pointed out by critics. But I'm often told how much my work echoes my mother's in terms of subject matter. And when I look at it, I think that's, you know, it's completely true. She wrote a lot about this movement between, you know, East, West, the two different worlds, and also very much preoccupied with topics of solitude, of exile, of feeling a foreigner, even in your own country, for a variety of reasons.
And of ownership, the sense of people being owned by their fate, by their history, by their identity for others.
Yes, certainly something one's so aware of in India, and that seems to be the location of Indian literature in a way. So talking of an individual up against these vast movements of history, of community, caste, religion, all these things that seem to claim you. And of course, it's a country that is where one is always so conscious of history. It does sometimes seem to be something that just catches one by the throat, doesn't let one go. And my goodness, we are really being taught that today in so many ways in India. You look at all the conflicts, they all go back to very, very old stories. And sometimes we think we're going back to the original myths.
Your mother is the novelist Anita Desai. Is it true that you wrote parts of this novel side by side in the same room as she was working on a book of her own?
Certainly in the same house. Sometimes I'd be upstairs, she was downstairs, or I would be in the kitchen, she would be in the veranda. And I wrote a lot of my first book in a house and a lot of the second. And when I was really pulling the book together, that really hard time of bringing it all together, cutting, editing, I did that entirely in her house.
Now, the hopes of all these characters are disappointed. Sai has had a romance, having been advised by a neighbor spinster that she should find a man while she can, because before long you'll be sitting in your house having the experiences you've had for your entire life over and over again.
Yes, and to escape into the modern world.
Bijou comes home, and by the time he reaches home, he's been robbed and stripped, and he's wearing a woman's nightie. The judge has lost his dog, which is perhaps the only creature he feels a shred of emotion that he knows about. He concedes that he owes something to Sai, that she is a miracle in his life. And the cook, well, the cook is about to meet the son who has failed in America after all of the dreams that the cook has had, that this has been the site of a great success for his son. And one gets the sense, reading the book, that in the modern world, there is no way for one's hopes to be fulfilled, that we're living in the midst of a kind of world that no longer is interested or about the satisfaction of dreams.
Well, you know, I think in so, again, it seems so contrary to the way we're, what we're told when we are growing up or what we're supposed to be seeking for, but I was very much trying to capture those little moments of realization that happiness is perhaps not the the simple, whole, selfish thing we wish it was. Maybe it is something quite different. Maybe that sort of selfish desire for one's own happiness, one's attaining one's own destiny, one sort of being in charge of it, finding one's being satisfied in life, being contented, and thinking of it as something to search for. Maybe that is not really an ethical search. Maybe it's not a fair search. And certainly, growing up in a very complicated country like India, in a part of the country that I describe, many different people shifting borders, a past that doesn't hold true either. Maybe that sort of happiness is not really possible. Maybe that sort of selfish idea isn't. Maybe it's a more compromised and therefore a more mature happiness. Maybe it has a very tiny location for that reason. You know, it might not that Yoko's, you realize, I think, that your story, it's not really your story. It belongs to many people, and they may have greater claim on that landscape and on that territory. And I think that is the sort of growing up experience that I wanted to capture in terms of talking about Sai, but also about Bijou and the judge and the way he returns home. And it seems like a tragic return, and yet it really isn't in so many ways, because he's realized that he's made an emotional decision instead of an economic one. The world being what it is, he's actually managed to rescue some of his dignity, in a way restore some of his dignity in that journey, so contrary towards what you're supposed to do and just the way you grew up in most of the third world. You're just brought up to leave no matter what class you come from.
Now, given this understanding of happiness, what does that mean to a novelist? A novel, you know, usually in its final pages is about drawing together goose chords, and the novels that the Anglophiles like, the Austen, the Trollope,
yes,
and others, usually end with a wedding and the resolution of satisfactions. So
yes.
Not everything is delivered. But what is a novel to end like now, and how did you find a way to end this one?
No, you're right. It is. I mean, it has been a growing up experience. This book was a very personal book in that way. It wasn't like my first book at all. It was a much closer journey, and I changed. I changed as a person while writing it. Became in many ways a sad person. Although, you know, I mean, obviously you. Perhaps your sense of humor develops all the more because of that. but I love the kind of ending that those Anglophiles on the hills like to read, that Trollope and Jane Austen. And, you know, I grew up reading those books. And that rhythm of a narrative is very secure and cozy to me. It's completely the rhythm that gave me security as a child. And still when I'm traveling on the plane and I'm, you know... uneasy and anxious, I'll read Jane Austen because it's like a blanket. and I so love those endings. And as a person and as a writer, to sort of undo them and to force a different rhythm on the narrative was certainly difficult. And you know, you're right. It's a repetition. It repeats the past, the present. The different characters echo each other with variations because, of course, every human reacts to circumstances differently. Biju may react to America one way, Said from Zanzibar another. The judge may lose his humanity. Biju might have retained it. The judge may have become so... English hates his Indianness. Biju has become more stereotypically Indian in a way, retained that language we were talking about, those jokes, that humor. So it's all, it sort of gets played in those different tones. But I knew that I couldn't end this book neatly or with a bow at the end, that a purely simple happy ending would not be fair. It would be against everything I had been writing. And neatly tying it up would also be against it. It could just show those moments of repetition and leave it at a particular moment.
I've been speaking with Kiran Desai, the author most recently of The Inheritance of Loss, published in paperback by Grove Press and winner of the Man Booker Award, as well as the NBCC, the National Book Critics Circle Award. Thank you, Kiran, for joining me.
Thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt from The Inheritance of Loss at kcrw.com/bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is J.C. Swadek, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.